Support for Art Talks comes from the Bucktown Center for the Arts at 225 East 2nd Street in downtown Davenport, with 16 independent studios and galleries offering original fine art and gift ideas in one location. Information is at bucktownarts.com. And from the Blue Cat Brew Pub, located in the district of Rock Island, serving food and handcrafted ales and lagers. And from Red Band Coffee Company, local roaster, offering individually prepared coffees, New Orleans-style iced coffee, and whole bean coffee at two locations in Davenport. Information is at redbandcoffee.com.
Well, hello and welcome. You've tuned into a conversation between artists. For the next hour, we'll be exploring the mind and the creativity of our guest. This is Art Talks, and I'm your host, Bruce Carter. Hello once again and welcome. We have a prairie artist with us today, George Olson, up from Woodhull, Illinois. Marvelous artist. He's having a show right now at the Dubuque Museum of Art until November 30th. He's an artist, a conservationist, and an Augustana alumni. Marvelous stuff. His work is focused almost exclusively on the grasses and the wildflowers of the North American prairie. His interest evolved from his earlier landscape drawing and paintings, and in addition to his role as an artist, Olson has been involved with prairie restorations throughout Illinois for more than 25 years. A very early job of his was in a landscape company. Plant studies have been shown all over the world, London, Scotland, Japan, Australia, South Africa, and Brazil. And he also was on the faculty of Worcester in Ohio, the College of Worcester, where he taught from 1963 until the year 2000. He's been an artist in residence, and he's here with us today. And George Olson, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's always been a pleasure. You've been on, I think, maybe three times in the last 20 years, maybe more, whenever you have a show. And your work is really terrific.
Thank you. It's well seen.
The color is very subtle. You serve the image by providing a platform for the plant to bloom. It's almost like you're doing a portrait of something. The background is clean and white, and there's a tenderness and a delicacy and a love just permeating your work. Very nicely done. Tell us about your life. Tell us about how you came up, and why aren't you doing, say, figurative portraits and printmaking? We share the printmaking background.
Well, I've had a pretty varied life since I became an artist at the University of Iowa back in the 60s. And sometimes this turns up when I compare notes with other plant artists who have come a more traditional way. They start out as plant artists and they end up as plant artists. I obviously started out in a different direction. I was doing huge oil paintings as part of my major at the University of Iowa. And then after about 10 years, I switched over to relief prints, and some of these became pretty spectacular with numerous pounds of scrap metal and scrap plywood and whatnot. The blocks for these relief prints became almost like sculpture, and sometimes the blocks were actually exhibited along with the prints.
Terrain.
And I only mention that, it's one more phase along the way. I didn't really take up the plant as a subject until I was in London in the 1970s, and even then I was a bit half-hearted about it until a few years later, and I thought, since I had married into this prairie family and we were spending a lot of time in the tall, in what used to be the tall grass prairie, maybe that would be a good focus for these plant studies. And one thing led to another, and I became more and more interested in the specific plants, and I started taking some prairie tours from people who knew about the plants, doing a lot of reading, looking in manuals and plant identification books, talking to the right people, going to some of the restored prairies and around St. Louis and around the Quad Cities, Chicago, Madison, Wisconsin. And that's really what led to the kind of concentration in prairie plants that you're talking about.
Interesting. You're like a fish that got pulled in very slowly, and you resisted the whole time.
It wasn't a very neat process. It was kind of roundabout.
Uh-huh.
But one thing, as I said, led to another.
Uh-huh. Well, and the other worlds that you inhabited before you landed in plants, what were they like?
The other subjects?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was always interested in the landscape, and so the paintings I was doing at Iowa as part of my thesis, they were landscapes, most of which had been somewhat smitten by the New York abstract expressionist school.
Me too.
In fact, that was sort of the going thing at Iowa, although we didn't always acknowledge it at the time. The relief prints, which came a little bit later, were totally abstract, made up of spare parts and found objects and bits of plywood and so forth.
Did you roll ink across
them?
Yeah.
Hmm. They were printed just like a traditional woodblock.
Huh.
And the biggest ones were pretty amazing. They required Suzuki rice paper, 3 feet by 6 feet. And just keeping the registration in line was kind of interesting.
With a wooden spoon or a roller?
No.
How did you print them?
Just the palm of my hand with
really?
The pressure.
Oh, because the paper was so thin. Huh, right. Color, black and white?
No, there were a lot of color.
Huh.
I did one sort of tour de force of based on the subway system in London, which had 11 different colors.
Oh, golly.
All of which had to be kept registered every time you printed it.
Sounds like a lot of work.
But even this wasn't, these subjects and techniques did not come in neat little packages. I was usually doing other things simultaneously, drawings of all kinds. I never abandoned the drawing, whatever the subject might be. And this ranged from trees and antique shops. And I did a whole decade or so of what I called my outdoor still lifes. Other people called them junkyards. And I think it was part of my discovery of the state of Illinois and the flatness of the landscape, having come all the way from Minnesota, where I was brought up in one of the most spectacular scenic valleys along the Mississippi River. And it took a bit of an adjustment to get used to that landscape.
Hmm.
I'm not sure I can go into all of the details, but it certainly had an impact on the kind of artwork that I was doing.
Mm. Lisansky told me that he never would have stayed in Iowa City unless the landscape had been beautiful, and that he found much to be admired in the rolling hills of Iowa, those kind of voluptuous Grant Wood farmland scenes. They're just terrific.
I think part of the problem when you come from a quote, more scenic area with lots of water and big tall bluffs and so forth, is that when I first got to this part of Illinois, the first thing that you see are the crops, the corn and the soybeans and so forth, because that's where the roads are. It takes a little bit of exploring and perseverance to get to some of the more hidden crannies where it's a little bit closer to what you were used to back home.
Hmm.
So I soon discovered, whether it was Black Hawk Park or some other scenic area along the river or whatever, that Illinois was not completely bereft of scenic areas. And by scenic, I mean areas that are interested and are not being devoted to crops and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't take too long before I was quite a disciple of the Illinois landscape, mm-hmm. if you knew where to look.
Mm-hmm. There was a painter, long name, I can't think of him right now, from Nebraska, and he would have very low slung landscape with tons of sky, and then he'd write the weather conditions underneath. Are you mm-hmm. familiar with his work? I can't think of it. I know he's a Nebraska painter.
And there's a book that came out about 10 years ago by, I think his name is Joni Kinsey over in the University of Iowa in the art history, called Plain Pictures. And it's a whole summary of the painters and photographers who have been working on not only the tall grass prairie, but the Great Plains that are a little bit further west.
Mm. So how did you go from being a landscape artist to being a plant artist, an individual plant artist?
Well, I think it's just taking a closer look. A lot of my early landscapes were kind of generalized. You just sort of did a lot of brushy-looking grass and background hills and so forth. But as I got better acquainted with some of the plants on the ground or up close, and also discovering some artists who had already made that discovery, then I thought maybe we should zero in and almost like a zoom lens
mm-hmm.
and get a closer look at some of these coneflowers and grasses and prairie thistles and things like that.
Mm-hmm. How do you work? How do you set that up? I mean, is it an objective laying out on a white background and then you draw it out or you photograph it? How do you approach this kind of image?
Well, every one of them, even though they're called watercolors as finished products, they start out as rather complete pencil drawings. And in a few cases, they've even been exhibited as pencil drawings before I decided to get into the color. That's a little unusual, but it has happened.
That great black and white, you can't beat it.
Yeah. Once in a while, I resolve to get away from color altogether and get back to black and white because color can be so frustrating, and you mm-hmm. wonder, why am I going through all this agony, and all I have to do is put the paint away and stick with black and white. And I certainly have no complaints about black and white.
Yeah, spoken like a printmaker. But continue. Mm-hmm. How do you attack an image of a plant? Do you lay it out? Do you go out in its habitat?
Well, it depends on the plant. If you're talking about some really rare orchid or gentian or something or butterfly weed or something which is maybe only one specimen in the whole prairie, or such a small number of specimens that you wouldn't think of snapping it off or digging it up or something, then you have to either photograph it and work from photo, or you have to camp out in the prairie and work directly, which I have done. It has a few problems of its own. You're subject to wind and insects and rain and whatever, or sunshine, which is too bright. Usually, most of the plants I've worked with, the goldenrods and the grasses and so forth, are abundant enough that you don't have to feel too guilty about snipping one off and bringing it into the studio, which is the way I like to work. Now, some plants behave better than others as subjects. Some of them start wilting right away, and some are almost impossible. You have a little chicory, for example, that grows along the roadside. Can be seen as a rather beautiful plant. You get this whole row of blue chicory in full bloom. But try to snip one off and bring it into the studio, and you've just got a little slimy a mess on your hands. But there are other plants that hold their shape rather well, even in the green stage. You know, if you keep them in water and keep the water topped up, you've got a good subject. And of course, the ones I like are the winter species, where they last forever. I've still got plants I picked off 3, 4, 5 years ago in the wintertime, and they're just that well preserved.
Hmm. What is it about prairie plants, and why not roses or dandelions?
Well, I've done all of them too. When I started doing plants, I was pretty eclectic. I was doing all kinds of weeds and houseplants and tree blossoms, anything that was a plant. And that's where the lack of focus started to wear on me a little bit. And I thought, you know, why not focus, and of course other artists have faced the same thing, and they focused on plants of a particular area or a particular climate or whatever. But spending as much time as I was, even while I was teaching in Ohio, we spent a lot of time out here in Illinois. I know that it's a good way to make use of the plants growing, or the plants that used to grow abundantly in this particular area.
Speaking with George Olson, O-L-S-O-N, an artist taught for many years at Worcester College in Ohio. He'll be having a show at the Dubuque Museum of Art until November 30th. His marvelous plant portraits. There really are kind of portraits. They're not an illustration. You're not just picturing the plants. Mm-hmm. You're really describing their personality.
Well, I've always been pretty nervous about the word illustration because to me it suggests some kind of technical manual or something where you are, for one thing, much more precise about some of the details like seed capsules and ovaries and all the bits and the stamens and pistils and so forth, which I've never really gotten into. I've done a bit of it, but not to the point where I could. In fact, I've turned down some jobs at illustrating because I just didn't think I could be that disciplined and systematic.
Precise?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the abstraction is still rolling through you then.
Well, it's not really abstraction. You're just sort of skipping over some of the details that, you know, I'm always amazed at to see these plant portraits, but then down in the corner you get a whole row of dissections and things which the artist has done for the benefit. Usually this is done in much earlier times, like the 18th or 19th century, where they literally are telling plant experts, teachers and scientists and so forth, exactly how this plant is put together and what happens if you take it apart.
So your intent is different with these images.
Yeah, I'm much more interested in simply portraying the plant as a whole specimen. Although occasionally I will do a detail of a seed pod or a leaf or a few thorns or something like that, the kind of thing you would see yourself if you were looking very closely at this plant.
Huh. So it's really a portrait. You're communicating mm-hmm. with your audience to do what?
Well, it's almost like a kind of a notebook sketch. For me, it's a way of learning something about the plant, of discovering the plant, getting better acquainted with it. Then if, in portraying the plant, this also passes it on to the viewer, some other person, so be it. But I'm very modest about my ability to convince other people and bring them into the fold, so to speak. So I think the first focus is simply discovering the plant for myself and clarifying the plant, you know, and there's no better way to clarify anything than to make a detailed drawing of it. And as I said, then through exhibitions and slide talks and so forth, if I've made a few discoveries, there's maybe by chance I can pass some of that on to my viewers and my listeners.
What discoveries?
Well, simply the plant itself, mostly.
The beauty of the plant?
Confronted by it. A good example, I took a prairie tour with my father-in-law, conducted by a rather famous prairie expert down in Lafayette, Illinois. His name was Jock Engels, and we met early one Saturday. And I was arrogant enough to think I already knew all the plants that we were going to see, and was amazed to find out that there were dozens of plants that I had never heard the names of. Jock was that knowledgeable. I think we covered some 82 plants just in that one day, and a huge number of those were new to me, and it took another batch of drawings to get acquainted.
Nice. It's always nice to be humbled and to have something new in front of you that you have yet to discover.
I felt properly humbled.
Very nice. Well, as part of Dubuque Week with WVIK, which is the week of September 15th through the 21st, George Olson is with us, and George has the show of his plants, paintings, watercolors, at the Dubuque Museum of Art until November 30th. Time for a short break right now. Let's take one, and we'll be right back after this gallery guide.
On exhibit around the WVIK listening area at the Augustana College Art Museum through October 25th, A Different Way of Seeing, Swedish Art from the Charters Collection. Hours are noon to 4, Tuesday through Saturday. In the Art Space Gallery in Building 4 on the Blackhawk College campus in Moline through September 19th, paintings by David Murray. Hours are 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday. In the Galvin Fine Arts Center on the St. Ambrose University campus in Davenport in the Morrissey Gallery, through September 28th, Mixed Media Works by Heather Baker. Hours are 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Friday. In the Kanich Gallery, through October 24th, Book Works by Brian Borkert and Quilts by Eric Wolfmeyer. Hours are 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Saturday. At the Figge Art Museum on West 2nd Street in Davenport, through October 26th, Living Proof, works by cancer survivors and patients. Through November 2nd, two Americans in Paris, Stuart Davis and Grant Wood. Through January 25th, Turned Wood. And through April 30th, A Legacy for Iowa. Hours are 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Tuesday through Sunday, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Thursday. At Midcoast at Center Station on River Drive in Moline through September 30th, drawings by Ann Kaufman and Mixed Media Works by Isaias Mejia. Hours are 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. on Saturday, 9 to 5 Sunday. At Midcoast Gallery West on 2nd Avenue in Rock Island through the end of October, acrylics by Dan Johnson and jewelry by Monica Shans. Hours are 11:30 to 5:30 Wednesday through Saturday. At the Bucktown Center for the Arts on East 2nd Street in Davenport through the end of October, photography by Richard Kluel and Matthew Terry. Hours are Wednesday through Saturday from 11 to 6. At the Quad City Arts Gallery on 2nd Avenue in Rock Island through October 24th, Good Enough to Eat, an art buffet. Hours are Tuesday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., Saturdays from 11 to 5. At Quad City Arts at the airport in the Moline International Airport through October 30th, Mixed Media Works by Kimberly Rocha, collages by Amber Williams, and stoneware by Dale DeBokey. And that's a look at current exhibits around the WVIK listening area.
Back on Art Talks with George Olson, O-L-S-O-N, a marvelous artist, taught for many years at Worcester College in Ohio. He's out of Iowa City, Iowa, in with his MFA there, and an Augustana student many years ago before that. But let's talk about your show. Your show is at the Dubuque Museum of Art, very cool, curated by Stacy Peterson.
Right.
How did that come about?
Well, it was certainly in the works for a long time compared to some of the shows I do, which are more slightly more short notice. 2-3 years ago, we had the bright idea of doing a show there, and it's a very kind of a slow process. You send in slides and whatnot, and then eventually you get a verdict saying that you might qualify for a show here. We'll let you know, which they do eventually. And I think this is probably based on some, I don't know if there's a committee or some group that has the final say.
There is.
Once it was in the bag, then it was simply a matter of keeping in touch. And at the last minute, I provided images of all of the works that would be in the show so that Stacy, the curator, could work this all out on her computer. So by the time I deliver the work to Dubuque, she's got it pretty well worked out as far as how it's going to fit the space and so forth.
Did you have any problem choosing what to put in it? Current work, old
no,
work?
Not really. There were mostly taking out things that might be duplications. I have some favorite subjects where I sometimes end up with more than I need at the moment of a particular prairie dock leaf or whatever. So then I pick out the one or two that are at the top.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't a very painful process. It's a big enough show that it sort of cleaned out the studio. I didn't have a whole lot of decisions to make about what to use. The remaining ones went over to Bishop Hill, where I usually keep a few things on consignment over there. And then I always have a sprinkling of things at Galesburg and one or two other places.
Mm-hmm. You don't seek to survive on selling your art, then?
No, that's the good news. In fact, I don't think sales will be a huge issue up in Dubuque, because it's primarily a museum. And they don't really see themselves as a commercial gallery or a gallery where they stress sales. Mm-hmm. They do have a little shop off to the side, and that's where my book will be sold during the duration of the exhibition,
mm-hmm.
The Elemental Prairie.
Do you try to sell your work? I mean, do you seek that?
Well, I never turn down a chance to, if somebody's really interested. And I've met some interesting people through people who have made acquisitions and have shown interest in the work. In some cases, they become acquaintances or good friends.
You meet through the work.
Mm-hmm.
Like meeting through children.
And I've kept pretty accurate records of who has acquired what. They're not terribly, not the sort of thing you have to do, but it's just kind of interesting to look back and see what was acquired from which exhibition. And on a more practical level, we try to keep track of which things we give away as gifts, because sometimes you give the same person another gift and you don't want it to be a duplicate.
That's a good
These
one
would
too.
Be close yeah. relatives and friends. And
yeah. So. Do you donate work?
Oh, yes. I think a lot of not-for-profit groups depend on artists where they have silent auctions and so forth. So I get a lot of requests for the odd print or small drawing or whatever. And I'm perfectly willing to do that if it's a worthy cause.
Huh. Do you frame your own work?
Oh, yes. Well, they're done with frame kits.
You cut the mats?
Yes. And in some cases, if it's a show that's close by and it's somewhat feasible, I give the buyer, if any, the option to...
Sure.
To deframe it, if they aren't interested in that frame, I'll be glad to take it back.
Yeah. You're a one-man operation, then. You make, you can frame
I sometimes have visions of these famous artists who do the work on the easel, and then they turn it over to some technicians who do everything else, including the sales and the framing and the booking and so forth. But I haven't gotten to that point yet.
You don't have to. I don't think Blake did. I think he made his own.
Actually, I used to talk to my students about this. The technical side sometimes comes in rather handy as a switch from the creative side. I've never complained too much about things like framing or stretching canvases or matting. The technical side has a place. I find it kind of therapeutic if you've put in a long stint of creative work. Why not switch over to the more technical side, which is completely different?
Yeah, making ink, stretching a canvas, creating that.
Just yeah, that used to be a big part if you were painting on oil. I'm painting on canvas with oil or acrylic. Keep the canvases stretched. Hope the stretchers wouldn't start warping on you.
Have you found, George Olson, different times of your life call for different images, or that you have different desires to get out of your art? I mean, when you're younger, perhaps you're defining yourself through your work. This is who mm-hmm. I am, and this is what I'm interested in, and you're expressing something that you're not even aware of, perhaps. It's like, oh, I didn't know I liked to paint this way. And then as you get older, you paint. It's not so much an act of discovery, but you're discovering maybe the subject matter yourself too. But then I think there's some flight, there's some soaring where you're not really talking about yourself or talking about your subject matter, but there's something else going on. Do you know what I mean? Have you felt that? Mm-hmm. Can you describe it?
Well, I think we can all cite other artists too, where there was a lot more going than simply the subject itself, whether it's Piranesi with his prisons and so forth. Or the dark side of almost every artist, where there's something going on. And by dark, I don't mean sinister or anything. It just may mean a bit more somber or sad or whatever. Now, in my own work, I find even among prairie plants, there are some cheerful, happy plants. It's sort of hard to take a purple coneflower and make it look as though it's not fairly straightforward and I don't know if that's the best example, but there are others too. Whereas the winter version, which again I discuss in my book, The Elemental Prairie, I talk about the kind of sculptural, architectural quality of some of these silphiums, for example, in the wintertime. And they're substantial enough subject, and there's enough going on there that it can also be expressing a very somber mood or a dark mood or a complicated mood, quite apart from the more cheerful aspect of some of the summer flowers. And it's no accident that a lot of prairie plants, prairie flowers, have found their way into gardens. Coneflowers is another good example. Coreopsis and black-eyed Susans, obedient plant and so forth. And the more, so this is the cheerful side. I don't know if cheerful is the right word either, but the more positive, colorful side that attracts almost everybody. Some people are not so turned on by the dark side, you know, the winter versions. They think during the winter everything is dead, everything is disgusting, and we're just waiting for spring to come around. But for some of us, the winter version of a prairie or of a garden or a tree, for that matter, is just as attractive as the summer side.
And this is a reflection of the artist?
Well, it's a reflection of the person. It could be a poet. You know, if you read Wind in the Willows, for example, there's some very eloquent prose there about what the trees look like when all the foliage is gone. Robert Frost has a wonderful poem called November. Not yesterday I learned to know the love of bare November trees before the coming of the snow, and so forth.
Nice.
So one of my hobbies on the side is collecting literature and other artists who respond to the same subjects that I respond to. And I guess you'd say if I had to pick my own favorites, it would be the winter versions of some of these prairie plants. It's what one of my colleagues out in Ohio started calling them, the crunchy ones. And he wasn't too far off.
After the fall. Very, very nice.
Well,
nice discovery.
We're looking at an example right here.
This is the alumni magazine from the College of Worcester, Different Lenses, an intersection of people, plants on campus, and on the cover is George Olson's...
Tall goldenrod.
Tall goldenrod.
In winter.
So you're a winter plant artist.
I love it. I love winter in general, too.
Do you?
When we get a blizzard, the phone starts ringing and people saying, I hope you're happy.
Give me the beach any day and I'll be happy. Mm-hmm. You thrive in the snow and the
Well, I don't like to make a fetish of it, but I just like every season to be the way it's supposed to be. I don't, out in Ohio, we used to get some rather bleak, wet winters that didn't really amount to much. There was no snow. It was just muddy and foggy and whatnot, which to me wasn't really winter. So if you get a really classic winter with a few good blizzards mixed in and so forth, that keeps me happy. Mm. Not to mention the way the prairie plants look as they're windblown and dried up.
I remember in printmaking when the winter would come, the fall would disappear, it took about 10 days to 2 weeks for the winter to actually enter into my plates, into my prints. You're doing the fall, you're doing the colors, you're doing the lines, the dark, and then gradually this snow-covered plain becomes with little bits of dark coming up. But it would take a while to kind of percolate through my system before it finally arrived on my image.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting thing for me to see that accumulation of time going through like that. Very interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit about your process. You lay the pieces out. You take them back. You have them in water. Sometimes they die. Sometimes they don't. You draw them out in pencil. You like them in pencil.
Mm-hmm.
And you've even shown some of the drawings in pencil. What pencil do you use to draw them out? What paper?
Well, it's a 4H pencil. It's about
4H?
The hardest thing. I started out using much softer pencils, but then I discovered the line was sometimes getting in the way of things, especially if you're doing a prairie plant with a very delicate yellow color, or even, heaven forbid, a white. The pencil line remains very visible and somewhat distracting.
Hmm.
You can get by with it if it's a dark purple plant, like a daisy, an aster or coneflower. But then I began experimenting with harder pencils just to keep the line. I mean, this sounds like a pretty simple problem to have to solve. But I discovered the harder the pencil, the lighter the line, and the less distracting it gets in the finished product.
Mm-hmm. How far do you take it in pencil? Do you put in shadow or do you put in background?
I usually drop a few hints about the shadows, not so much the finished product, but just to remind me that when I get to the watercolor, this is going to be in deep shade.
Hmm. And so as you finish, you have enough information in the line, and then you put down the 4H pencil, and then you take out the watercolor.
Switch over to watercolor.
What kind of watercolor do you use?
Winsor & Newton, exclusively, partly because over in London that was pretty prominent, but over here it is too.
Mm-hmm. Use their brushes too?
Any brush I can get a hold of that does the job.
Sable, and, synthetic, Teclon.
It's amazing how if I get a brush that really does the job, I use it forever, and I sort of neglect all the other brushes. But I use different sizes depending on the detail I'm getting into.
Mm-hmm.
But none of them terribly huge. Most of them are quite tiny because of the detail.
Do you have a visor? Do you have a lens?
Oh. No. Well, I do have a lamp that has a lens built into it, but I never found that I could work with it very efficiently. I have to look directly at what I'm doing.
So it's mostly light in a particular area then?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I always had trouble with those lens magnifying lamps too.
Well, it probably works for some people who can get used to them, but I can never quite get used to looking through this lens at the subject.
Very nice, very nice. Well, we're speaking with George Olson, who has the show at the Dubuque Museum of Art until the end of November. Terrific show, 34 pieces?
39
pieces, and it's curated by Stacy Peterson up there. Marvelous, marvelous artist. Let's take another break right now, and we'll be right back after this gallery guide.
On exhibit around the WVIK listening area at the Geneseo Art League Gallery on South State Street in Geneseo, Wood Art Show, works by Jim Dayton, Bob Benson, Carl Smith, and Warren Hadley. Hours are 11 to 5 Wednesday through Saturday. At the Renee Gray Gallery on South Cody Road in Eclair through September 28th, A Personal Perspective, Finding Beauty in the Unexpected, works by Lee Kimball and other artists. Hours are 11 to 5 every day except Sunday. at Roztalks on 3rd Avenue in Rock Island on continuing exhibit, Object Permanence, works by 20 local artists. Hours are 11 to 1 a.m. Tuesday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 11 p.m. on Sunday. At the Galesburg Civic Arts Center at 114 East Main Street in Galesburg, through September 16th, Galesburg High School Art Student Honorees, from September 12th through October 18th, works by Joyce and Jeffrey Gellick. Hours are Tuesday through Friday from 10:30 to 4:30, Saturday from 10:30 to 3. At the Buchanan Center for the Arts on the Square in Monmouth through October 25th, the Security Savings Bank Photo Competition. Hours are 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, Saturdays from 10 to 2. At the Muscatine Art Center at 1314 Mulberry Avenue in Muscatine through January 25th, Railroads of Muscatine County. Hours are Tuesday through Friday from 10 to 5, Thursday evening 7 to 9, Saturdays and Sundays from 1 to 5. At the Dubuque Museum of Art at 701 Locust Street in Dubuque through October 19th, Modern Landscapes, paintings by Grant William Tye. Through November 30th, Homage to the Tall Grass Prairie, watercolors by George Olson. The Grant Wood Gallery on continuing exhibit. Hours are Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 10 to 5, Thursdays until 7 p.m., Saturdays and Sundays from 1 to 4. At the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art at 410 3rd Avenue in Cedar Rapids, through November 2nd, Marvin Cohn, On My Mind, The Ceramics of Dean Schwartz. On continuing exhibit, Art in Roman Life, Grant Wood in Focus, and Maurizio Lozanski, Master Printmaker. Hours are Tuesday through Saturday from 10 to 4, Thursdays 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., Sundays noon to 4. And that's a look at current exhibits around the WVIK listening area.
And we're back on our talks with George Olson. George is a prairie artist, marvelous stuff of plants from the Midwest, from Illinois, from our area. And he has a show in Dubuque until the end of November. This program and many, many previous programs going back over 2 years are available at our website, wvik.org. Click on the schedule link at the top of the page and scroll on down to Art Talks and touch on that, and they will appear by date, the name of the artist, and a brief description of what they do, and you can listen to them at your leisure. As artists pass through different stages of their lives, I find George that there are different elements that become important, and you brought in a list of your references, your relationship to the Mississippi River, to rivers, mm-hmm. going through. You know, early Greek philosophers said that there's no life without water, and in a sense, civilization without mm-hmm. the river is the same thing. Do you want to talk about your relationship with the land and the river? Is that something special for you?
Well, I'm not sure it has any special meaning, but just for the fun of it, I kind of made a list of all the gigs I've had along the Mississippi River, starting with my hometown, Lake City, Minnesota, which is right on Lake Pepin, the widest spot in the whole Mississippi River, probably one of the more scenic spots, and it's an area that has an awful lot of history going back to the earliest explorations with Father Hennepin and Marquette and Joliet and some of the others, although I'm not sure they got that far north.
That's where you worked as a landscape employee?
Well, no, you're using the word landscape or rather. I worked for the Jewel Nursery in Lake City. All of the boys who were born in that town ended up working at these nurseries. And I've given a lot of thought to how this affects your attitude toward plants, because it's not a very positive attitude. You're hacking away at all these weeds and quack grasses and things that are, you know, they give you a row of baby trees about 200 yards long in the hot sun, and it's your job to get all the weeds out of that row. And you end up not having a terribly positive view of plants in general after you've put in a summer hacking away at weeds. And it's not only nurseries, but it's working for farmers or farm wives or your own mother in that regard.
Were you raised on a farm?
Did I what?
Were you raised on a farm?
No.
No.
But very close to one. And I started out working for the wife of a farmer just across the railroad tracks, and then later for the farmer himself. Back then they still had thrashing scenes and so forth that were, you know, right out of the old days. It was before the world got mechanized.
Why didn't you paint those kind of images?
Well, I used to do a lot of drawings of this kind of thing. As a child, I drew all kinds of farm scenes, cows and wagons and machinery and so forth, but somehow I never kept it up as an adult. Mm. But they're very interesting subjects. I think a lot of this ended up in my so-called outdoor landscapes, which a lot of people referred to as junk drawings. Not in the modern sense of a rather boring landfill, but in the more interesting sense of junk with real junk in it, old cars and furniture and whatnot.
Yeah, I'm thinking of John Bloom and Grant Wood, and they would paint their childhood farm scenes.
I never did those nice tidy fields and farm buildings and things like that, although I've gotten interested rather recently in winter scenes with old barns and things in them, partly to as a kind of a matrix for what the snow is doing in the sky and that sort of thing.
Hmm. Always the artist's eye.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Then after this, growing up on Lake Pepin until I was college age, then I came down to a different part of the Mississippi, to Augustana College, and where the Mississippi runs east and west. And that led to a lot of subsequent things, the exhibitions at Augustana and all the Rock Island exhibitions that come up once a year, although that's in limbo at the moment. Or waiting for a different date. Even some of the coursework at Augustana, you had professors like Hamming and Fritjof Frixell back in those days. It really made you aware of what was going on in the landscape. And, of course, there were getting acquainted with Black Hawk Park and other wilderness areas, some of the bogs and marshes and Arsenal Island and so forth. There's a wonderful prairie out by Colonel Davenport's house, which I've taken advantage of, although I didn't know about it back in my student days. And then since then, I've had gigs or adventures at Winona, which is on the Mississippi, and worked on the Milwaukee Railroad, which had the Mississippi River as part of its route.
What did you do?
Well, I was hoping you wouldn't ask.
We can pass by then.
I was spraying plants along the railroad. I just hope they were the right plants. That's been on my conscience ever since. I assume they were all disgusting weeds sweet clover and pigweed and so forth.
Huh.
But it's a very good chance there may have been a few prairie plants mixed in there that I was brutally getting rid of. And then even places like Burlington and certainly St. Louis, where I spent one whole semester at the Missouri Botanical Garden. That was a result of meeting somebody by chance over in London who was stationed or had a museum, had a library at the museum Missouri Botanical Garden. And one thing led to another, and I was artist in residence there for one semester, and then did an exhibition at the end of that, I've kept in touch with them ever since.
Sweet. What did you draw, paint all the plants?
I discovered a whole new batch of plants down in. You wouldn't think St. Louis would be all that different from the Quad City area, but
The climate.
Like the very first plant in the Elemental Prairie book is Maximilian sunflower, which I had never seen until I got down to St. Louis, and their Illinois bundleflower is another one. So I had a great time down in St. Louis discovering plants that I hadn't known about before. And it was really wonderful. If I discovered a plant I hadn't seen before or couldn't identify, I simply took it back to where my studio was. And there were experts, there were curators from the library, and Joseph Ewan was a world-renowned expert. He's the one who got me in touch with the garden in the first place. And so I never had trouble getting plants identified. And I have this marvelous arrangement now. If I discover a plant in the Woodhull area that I can't identify, I can wrap it up and send it to the Missouri Botanical Garden. And sure enough, I get a long letter back identifying the plant and telling me all about it.
Great.
Courtesy of George Yatskevich, who is one of the botanists down there and working on the flora of Missouri.
Excellent. What a great contact to have. You're almost like an entomologist or somebody who's studying bugs or trees or wildlife.
And then just by chance, or maybe it wasn't by chance, but John Madsen, who wrote the essay for the Elemental Prairie, he's deceased now, but he was from Godfrey, Illinois, which is almost a suburb of St. Louis, just up the river. And the one day that I spent with him was on the Mississippi River, checking out all the switchgrass, and he had a couple of private little prairies that he wanted me to see. And so we did some plant identification. It was really wonderful to get to know him. At the time, I was hoping to keep in touch with him and see more of him, but then he died tragically a few years after that.
I remember many years ago out near Cambridge, one of my good friends, Joe, took my son and me in an old pickup truck out, and there in the grasslands, tucked along a little stream between cornfields, was about an acre of original prairie.
Mm-hmm.
And you entered into it like you would enter into an old cathedral, that there was a different feel about it. The plants were completely different, that you felt almost a hollow ground. It was a different feeling completely. There's something super special about the prairie.
Do you remember the name of that prairie?
No, I don't.
Because the Munson Cemetery is about a mile or two north of Cambridge, and that is a real mecca for prairie people in this area. It's still used as a cemetery, but it's also, it has never been plowed and probably never even grazed, so you still have a wealth of prairie plants in this little. A lot of people know about the Munson Cemetery, even though they may be from miles away.
And it was so interesting. It was almost like I was visiting Stonehenge or something, that it was untouched, unplowed, ungrazed. I never thought of that. And the original, and Joe said that every year or so they would come in and they would torch it. They would burn it. It was like, what? Why would they want to burn it for? To burn off all the extra growth or extra plant or...
Well, burning is one of the things we prairie people do every year. I've got on our farm, we have two or three prairies. One is we call it the Johnson Prairie, which was the name of my father-in-law. He and I started that prairie back about 1982.
So you can start a prairie? You've got plant seeds in a package?
Well, you have to get the soil ready, which is no small thing, get all the weeds killed off, and the domestic grasses like Kentucky bluegrass and so forth. And then you seed the prairie with seeds from the Prairie Nursery up in Wisconsin, or you can get them from Peter Schramm down in Galesburg. Or in those days, you could get the seed from the Lafayette Nursery in Lafayette. And so we have that little prairie plot. And then I have another one that simply started up in a fence line, and I've been allowing it to expand. It's pure big blue stem. We call that the Sauconuck Prairie, which is a name borrowed from Chief Blackhawk down here. And then there's another prairie way out in the corner of the farm, which is a little, really, a kind of a farm pond from the 19th century, which has been allowed to grow back up in native grasses.
Sweet. Very nice.
But we don't burn that one off because it would be too dangerous, but the other two, every spring we burn it off, and that gets the plants, gives them a brand new start. The roots are not bothered by this burning, so as soon after the burning process, they all come up nice and bright and green, and they start the whole year over.
How interesting that you ended up doing this. I mean, you could have ended up painting landscapes, flowers, apples, portraits, but all the twists and turns, and it seems that your life was almost destined. You mentioned by chance two or three times in our conversation that this seems to be that your life has been pointing this way. All of the tributaries of experience are taking you toward being
I've always been amazed at how many things in everybody's life just happens by chance, chance meetings with people and chance events and so forth. My relationship with the Missouri Botanical Garden was purely by chance. I went to my beloved botanical library at the Natural History Museum in London, and I noticed that some Americans had signed in just ahead of me. So I asked the librarian, who are these Americans? And they said, that's Joseph Ewan and his wife, Nesta, from Missouri. So I looked them up, and they're sitting a few feet away doing research, and we just fell all over each other. I happened to be having an opening that evening in the Natural History Museum of my prairie watercolors. So they came to the opening and stayed for 2 hours, and one thing led to another. And pretty soon I get this letter from the president of the Missouri Botanical Garden.
I love things like that. George Olson, we've reached the end of our time. Time for the last question. What advice do you, as a teacher and as an artist, have for young artists?
Well, that's not easy, but I think I would recommend just getting on with it in terms of lots of drawing and exploration. Get acquainted with subjects, look into new subjects, unfamiliar subjects. And I think above all with the drawing, I would stick with the real subjects, in other words, real objects. Many times parents will bring their kids to me and show me their drawings, and it turns out they've simply been copying monsters out of all kinds of books and so forth.
Yeah.
And I try to wean them away from that, even though it usually ends up with hurt feelings and so forth. But that would be my advice, to keep working, keep drawing, keep exploring, and one thing will lead to another.
Perfect. George Olson, thank you very much. Very nice
thank
hour.
Thank you.
The Dubuque Museum of Art has a good show until November 30th, 39 pieces of George Olson's work there. That's it for us today on Art Talks. Many thanks to our guests. Many thanks to our audio engineer, that maestro of sound, Dave Garner. As always, I'm Bruce Carter. Until next week, have a great night and a fine tomorrow. See you soon, Laura.
Support for Art Talks comes from the Blue Cat Brew Pub, located in the district of Rock Island, serving food and handcrafted ales and lagers. And from the Bucktown Center for the Arts at 225 East 2nd Street in downtown Davenport, with 16 independent studios and galleries offering original fine art and gift ideas in one location. Information is at bucktownarts.com.